Our gospel and preaching text this morning is from John chapter 8. Glory to you, O Lord. Early the next morning, Jesus again came to the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. Now the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman forward who had been caught in adultery. And making her stand in front of all the people, they said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the very act of committing adultery. And the law says, according to Moses, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say?" Jesus bent over and drew with his finger on the ground. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is free from sin, who has never sinned, throw the first stone at this woman." Then he bent down and continued writing in on the ground. The crowd, once they had heard this, began to go away one by one, beginning with the elders, until all were gone and Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus straightened up and said to the woman, "Where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And the woman replied, "No one, sir." Then Jesus said to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Now go on your way, and from now on, sin no more." This is the gospel of the Lord. Praise to you, O Christ. Please be seated. And the children are invited to head out to the comfy chairs. I think, Michaela, what book are you reading, Michaela? Oh, Horton Hears a Who. There it is. What? Oh, yeah. Horton Hears a Who. That's a fun one. It would be something if the preacher then just walked out and listened to that story, wouldn't it? Now, as I begin preaching, just to be clear, I'm no longer playing the character of the devil. Just to be clear, that change of wardrobe and all that kind of stuff. If this is your first time here during this Lenten season, then you've been missing various retellings of that temptation story of Jesus. We decided that Jesus was in the wilderness for 40 days, and it's always the beginning of Lent. We decided that would be the context, really, for all that we're doing. And then we bring in, of course, another scripture to kind of point toward different aspects of it. Of course, today I'm talking about the devil and Satan and this impulse, this drive, whatever this is that has us sin. And I must confess, most of my time when I'm thinking about the temptations, I tend to think of myself personally. You know, and so I think if I was that hungry, yeah, it would be really tempting. So I think about how hunger tends to drive me and how it'd be nice to have the fame and respect and power and all that kind of stuff. And I think all about how, you know, the Satan may be whispering in my ear. But sometimes I wonder if that really captures the way Satan, the way evil, the way sin is really at work in the world. If that's the only way, kind of a little voice in our ear saying, "Go ahead, you know you want to, and you know it's not the right thing, but do it anyway." A little story. Back before I went to seminary, I was an electrical engineer, and this is back in Austin, Texas, and I was an engineer for 10 years. And most of that time, I worked on a project that eventually became the metallurgist. It was this wonderful little machine. Actually, it was kind of big, but the probe was not so bad. And what you could do with this thing is walk up to a piece of metal, stick it on there, punch the button, and in about 30 seconds, it would tell you exactly what alloy you had. Almost like magic, isn't it? You can do the same thing with, well, you don't want to know more about that. It was a great little machine. It was a big hit for our company, made lots of money. I really enjoyed working on that project. It challenged me in all kinds of different ways. Made some good money while I was doing it. Made the company a lot of money. And from many standards, it was great. As I now have some distance from that, golly, how long ago was that now? 20 years? 20 plus years. There's some things about that I wonder about. Because the heart of this machine was a little crystal, a mercuric iodide crystal. Now, when you hear the word mercury, what do you usually think? Poison. I mean, you may think thermometers, but I think we've all learned they don't make mercury thermometers for the most part, because that mercury's dangerous. It's very toxic. If you get it on your skin, if you ingest it, it's bad news. And so probably for every one little crystal, I'm making a really small, I mean, the crystals were about that big that we used. And of course, we only used the best ones. For each one of those, there were, it played on the order of a kilogram of mercuric iodide, powdered mercuric iodide that we would use to try to finally get one that would work. And of course, it's a toxic material. That means everything that touched it was now toxic. And so we were generating tons and tons of this basically toxic waste. And we abided by all the laws. We had somebody that was in charge of disposing of it. But I remember one time kind of just noticing there were just a bunch of steel barrels that were out behind, you know, not behind the property, but on the parking lot. And it kind of registered, oh, yeah, that's what we're creating. Again, followed all the laws. I hope and pray that what was done with that was appropriately, but I can't imagine any way any of that could be reclaimed. So it's probably sitting somewhere. Now, we can get into all kinds of conversations, was it bad or wrong? But there's something about it that feels sinful. For the ability, for the efficiency, for the for this product that does wonderful things, really helped a lot of folks do quality assurance and safety and also make lots of money. We also created this big problem that for the most part, I was just invisible to. And I want to talk about how that kind of is sin. Now, when I was doing it, it wasn't that I was devious trying to, you know, my plan, graduate from university, was not to go out and create lots of toxic waste that somebody somewhere else had to deal with. No, I was driven by, you know, wanting to get a good job, wanted to do a good job, wanted to, of course, make money, wanted to make a name for myself, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But somehow ended up participating in a system that is creating a big problem. And there's an aspect of sin that there's different words that people have used, kind of like sinful systems. It's where even the people well-intentioned inside the system who aren't evil are somehow participating in something evil when you step back and look from a broader perspective. And very often these systems seem normal. Now, one that we've been talking about a little bit, we've been referring back to passages from Deuteronomy, which reminds us about the story of how God saved the Hebrews from from being slaves in Egypt. I mean, that Egyptian system, if you think about pyramids, right? That pretty much describes their system. There was a pharaoh on top, and the higher up on the pyramid you were, the better off, and the lower that you were, the worse. But it was normal to have slaves. It was normal that somebody, all they had to do was say a word, move a finger, and lives could be destroyed. That was normal. Roman Empire, similar kind of system. That's what Jesus was kind of swimming in when he was walking on this earth. Nazism was one of those systems. The trains ran on time, order was restored, but it became normal for your Jewish neighbors and friends just to kind of disappear. It became normal that my micro, there we go, had a way of creating a new normal. There's a Christian theologian named Walter Wink, who I think has done the best work on this. And he talks about this, for this kind of corporate sin, I guess, corporate in the sense of kind of widespread. He talks in terms of principalities and powers. I like to think of it as like a spirit. And it's a system or a spirit that somehow when you get a group of folks together and it becomes normal to do things that if you were outside that system, you'd look back and go, that's not right, that's unjust. Within the system, it just becomes normal. Now, in extreme versions of this, we call it mob mentality, right? Where you work up a crowd and get them with torches and pickaxes and going after vampires or going after the king or whoever. But most of those things are so extreme, they catch our attention. The more subtle, the more insidious things are the ones that we are just occur as normal to us. When they brought the woman in front of Jesus who had been caught in adultery, there were some of these aspects of a sinful system going on. First of all, the most glaring one is, where was the man? It was normal that women were the ones to blame for adultery. It was normal that, according to the law, that such women should be stoned. There was no reciprocal or agreement that men should be stoned. It was normal that women were treated as a little bit less than man, and in extreme cases, like property. Property. It was normal. That was the system. It took extraordinary people to step outside of that. But the other system that was going on at work was the scribes and Pharisees who brought this woman before Jesus. I wish I could say that the church is never one of these sinful systems, one of these spiritualities that actually works against what God is up to. But it can be. In that case, it pointed to the legalism and the threat that Jesus represented to those scribes and those that were in religious authority. And something was going on there that did not feel like the love of God. My assertion is we are living in systems like that all the time. I didn't do an inventory, but if I looked to see where my shoes were made or my socks or my pants or my shirt, I'd probably coming up with places like Mexico and Indonesia and Malaysia and China and places like that. Do I know that there aren't abusive employment practices going on? Chances are it's some very, very poor, impoverished people that are responsible for some of the clothes that I made. That's sinful. And I'm participating in that by purchasing the clothes. It's everywhere. So what do we do about it? What do we do? In Galatians chapter 5, Paul is writing to the church in Galatia. And he's talking about the fruits of the flesh and the fruits of the Spirit. He has this wonderful verse. The fruits of the Spirit are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, generosity, and self-control. Against these there is no law. And I credit Pastor Laura in kind of introducing me to this particular verse. But it becomes a wonderful criteria for answering the question, is there something evil, sinful, going on in a group? Because you can ask yourself, is the Spirit of God present? Is there love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and generosity and self-control present? Or is there something else? Anger, vengeance, fear, greed, ruthlessness, There's all kinds of things. And I suspect that we all have those sensors. It feels like something's off. But on the other hand, these kind of systems, when folks get together, it just becomes normal. And unless we step back and actually ask the question, are the fruits of the Spirit present? It doesn't give us a lens to go, whoa, and then invite an inquiry into what we can do. What Jesus did is he shifted the conversation. Okay, if you're going to talk about sin, I invite you to do some interior work. Is any one of you sinless? And when he did that inquiry, it says the elders began first. The wiser ones amongst that group. Immediately they recognized that they had been caught up in something that was not of God. Here they were ready to stone a woman because of a sinful act. And they immediately recognized, yeah, that kind of wisdom and maturity. Once that spirit of wisdom and inquiry was opened up, they recognized, yeah, they had to drop their stones and they had to leave. And then everyone else left. This is a challenge. It's a lot of work to recognize the sinful systems that we're part of. But the payoff is having a life filled with the fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, generosity, and self-control. That is what Jesus invites us to do. Whatever spirit is present, we can bring that spirit of God, that spirit of hope, that spirit of love, of forgiveness. We can be the change agents to start naming and transforming systems that want to dehumanize, that want to entrap, that want to oppress. At the bottom, at the heart of these systems, I would assert, is some kind of fear. It's a fear of losing power. Fear of losing power, losing control, losing status, fear of losing something. And it may be losing security. It feels like what the life you have is threatened. But underneath it all is a fear. And when we are afraid, boy, what we want to do is we want to blame somebody or something. It's not right what's going on. And so if we can find someone else to blame, then it gives us a place to target that anger, target that frustration, target that fear. And we get some kind of payback. But actually what it does when we give into that, it actually helped perpetuate the system that we're in. The key to living a transformed, a spirit-filled life is to do what Jesus did. And what he did is he didn't see a woman who was caught in the act of committing adultery. He saw a sister. He saw one of his own who was about to be punished because the scribes and Pharisees were testing him and trying to get him to trip up so they could bring a charge against him. When we recognize that the person we're about to blame or the people that we're about to blame are actually us, then it gives a completely different way to start working toward that which is right and good and fair. As you were coming in today, you were invited. Did the ushers invite you to pick up a stone you'd like to throw? Or did they just say, pick up a stone? I noticed when I was picking this one, it's just like, it fits my hand really good. I used to play baseball. It'd probably tweak my shoulder because this is pretty heavy. But we have stones that we like to throw. We have people that we want to target. We have people that we want to blame. We want to take an outrage against somebody else. And Jesus' invitation, God's invitation, is to allow the Spirit to dwell within you. To find a way to recognize whatever spirit you're caught up in that's creating that anger and fear and all that kind of stuff, and to name that is not of God. It is not of God. And when you recognize you're picking up a stone, and of course, we usually don't throw real stones. We throw words. We use scatter shots of gossip and things like that. But in essence, we're hurling things intended to hurt, intending to make us look good and bring somebody else down. When we recognize that we're doing that to our brothers and sisters, to people that are us, then it gives us a completely different way to live in the world. And that way is called love. And oh my gosh, it is hard, because there are some people that really deserve to get a stone. But as soon as you give into that, Satan wins. I like this little skit that we did, and I didn't write it, but it was a gift to us, because it talks about the subtlety, how it uses simple desires just to be safe, to get some respect, to give what we deserve, and how we get sucked into things then that make us complicit, whether we acknowledge it or not. And when that happens, we're distracted from the call of God, the clearest command of God: love God and love your neighbor. And here's the bad news. If you're wondering if somebody's your neighbor, yes. The answer is they're all your neighbor. During the next hymn, I invite you to come up and lay your stone down. Whatever this stone represents, whatever it is that you want to take out on somebody else, where you recognize that they're no longer people to you, but in some form a demon or an evil person or somebody that doesn't deserve, I invite you to take all that and put it on this stone and come and lay it down and trust God and trust that the promise of God and trust that the promise that love works is a place to put your faith. Amen.